So this is the third week of our 9-week course. I'm going to spend one more day talking about mindfulness of body. And I want to sort of approach this from two different directions. One is, there's this interesting thing that I haven't mentioned before. and that is that in the sutta, you know, I've been reading sets of instructions on how, on the breath and on various body sensations. But after each section in the sutta, there's a thing called the refrain. So it's sort of like a long, you know, song. And after each verse on the song, they have a refrain that sort of repeats over and over again. And when I first started thinking about this refrain, I was wondering, well, why does the Buddha repeat this? It's actually 13 times in the sutta this is repeated. Why is this repeated 13 times? And what I came to realize as I looked at it more and more is what the refrain is the refrain is instructions on how to follow the instructions. Sort of like the second layer of instructions, in a sense, for all of the different things. I want to read the refrain and then talk about it, because it actually gives you some insight into this practice that you don't get just by reading, like, you know, did you breathe in long or short? Okay. So this is the words of the refrain. In this way, in regard to the body, he abides contemplating the body internally, or he abides contemplating the body externally, or he abides contemplating the body both internally and externally. Or he abides contemplating the nature of arising in the body. Or he abides contemplating the nature of passing away in the body. Or she abides contemplating the nature of both arising and passing away in the body. Or the mindfulness that there is a body is established in her to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. So it's a lot going on here. But really there's three main points that the Buddha is making here. The first one, I wondered about a lot till I talked to a few teachers and actually read some commentaries. And this is this phrase, he abides contemplating the body internally, and he abides contemplating the body externally. And basically, what the Buddha is getting at here is there's no difference in noises or motions or anything from this body, what I think of my body internally, and your body externally. What's the difference in terms of something to note? Nothing at all. You can equally note, you know, you're sitting there quietly meditating, right? And this is especially true in group practice, but also just, you know, there you are in your house and the person next door has decided to, you know, blow their leaves or whatever, you know, turn on their cement mixer or something. And there's this noise. And it's like, you have, at that point, what often happens is, oh, doesn't that person know it's the evening time, it's supposed to be quiet? Or if you're sitting in a hall with like 80 or 90 people and someone is making a ruckus, so ruckus is a relative term, it could be quite small amount of noise, but, and we think that there's something like wrong. This person should know better than to be making this noise. Or why are those people running in a cement mixer at this time of night? Or whatever we're thinking. Instead, what the Buddha is saying is, those noises, those external noises caused by other bodies than yours, or this that external motion, or whatever, are equally valid in terms of what we note. Instead of making it a problem, you just note it. Because that's what we're doing. It's, that's what arose, that sound arose in your sphere of noticing. And it caught your attention so strongly that it was prominent, so you just noted. Coughing, or rustling, or sneezing, or whatever it was, you know. If you ever meditate with a large group of people, there's always noise going on in the hall of various sorts. Little things, big things. And we get annoyed if we're not careful. You know, I had a friend who used to actually put in earplugs and an eye mask when she meditated in the hall with a group of people, as if that was going to somehow make it better. You know, so she was just saying, well, my internal things are more important than those external things. No, it's like, and if we live in the world day to day and we're practicing out in the world, there's going to be lots of noise. Even if you're practicing in nature, you know, there's flies buzzing and, you know, trees creaking and, you know, the sound of the brook, and because you're sitting beside a stream because it's so peaceful. But then there's that external noise that has nothing to do with this body, internal. That's equally valid thing to note and pay attention to. So that's what that's about. It's like expand your willingness to take in other things than just what you think is inside you. It's really what this comes down to. And then there's this phrase, or mindfulness that there is a body is established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. Now the Buddha is saying, wait a second, you don't have to note every little thing. Why not sort of step back and just somehow conglomerate all the physical sensations you're experiencing, the sounds, and the twitch in your knee and the itch in your nose and how the cushion feels on your butt and whatever, just all those things that are going on that you're experiencing. And you know, there's a lot of different physical sensations. Why can't we just sort of put that all together and be aware of it in some sort of broader sense? And what we're noticing is that there is a body. If we put all that sensation together, that's what defines a body. It's just, the body is just a mass of sensations, really. It's like we think that a body has a hand and an arm, but really what a body has is sensation. A variety of sorts and different parts of the body, both internally and externally, you know, externally on the skin and internally something gurgling in your stomach, whatever. Those are all just sensations. And so you could say, well, let's just pay attention to this mass of sensation, as opposed to trying to pay attention to every little thing. It's like, let's take the wide angle lens view as opposed to the microscopic view. Equally valid ways of practice in terms of mindfulness of body. And you can sort of shift back and forth in some sense. Some people prefer one versus the other, but it's like you start to learn that you can have flexibility in your practice, that just focusing totally on every little sensation sometimes can just be too much. It's like, oh my God, there's all this stuff going on. And instead, if you can step back and just say, okay, there's a lot of stuff going on, but I'll put that all together, and I have a body. That's it. That's all that's going on. And notice that the phrase is, there is a body, not I have a body, or this is my body. There's no possession here. There's just the sensation of this collection of physical experiences. Put it all together, and there is a body. It's not personal. And the Buddha, using the phrase, there is a body, makes it very clear when he's saying, don't personify this collection of sensations, because then you make them mine, and now you're separating mine from theirs. And but if I'm taking it internally and externally equally, it's all the same. It's just, that's what's going on right now. The third thing is, he's talking about, you know, nature of the rising in things arising in the body and nature of things disappearing, and both. And here he's talking about starting to pay attention to the fact that everything's impermanent, that things arise, they're there for a while, and they're gone. This is the nature of everything. And so part of noting things is not only noting when they're there, but also noting when they're gone. Things arise, and they're there for a while, and then they're gone. And it might, so noting, especially when something has been very predominant, it's been there for a while, and then it's like you notice, oh, it's gone. Noting the absence of something that's been there predominantly can be quite skillful, because it reminds you that everything arises, it's there for a while, and then it's gone. The tricky part here is this body seems real, and it seems separate from your bodies out there. You have separate bodies from my body, right? And to function in the day-to-day world, in what we'll call relative reality, we have to have some awareness that my body and this body ends here and that body starts over there. Otherwise, you know, it's chaos, right? So, in a sense, it's okay to think you have a separate body. But here's something one of my teachers, Guy Armstrong, really emphasized. Can you think of it in this context? Instead of my body, can we think, in this ever-changing stream of physical and mental phenomena, conventionally known as Barry, as opposed to my. Now it's just acknowledging that what I'm thinking about is my, and I have to do that if I'm functioning in the relative world. In terms of absolute, it's nothing but made up of a continuously changing stream of physical and mental phenomena. And thinking of my body in that way isn't a problem, because you're acknowledging right up front that the idea of my body being separate isn't true. Because all I'm saying is, what I think of as my body and have to be aware of as my body when I'm functioning in the world of relative reality is nothing more than this stream of physical and mental phenomena conventionally known as Barry. I mean, out there in the real world, we can't go, well, no, I don't have any name because I don't, you know. We have to know that this collection of sensations I'm talking about actually has a name attached to it out there when I'm interacting with other people. I can't ignore that as much as we would want to sometimes. We have to just accept that, yeah, I have to sort of function in that world with this relative world I live in. And then the last thing is, in this refrain, he says, or mindfulness that is established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. The extent necessary. In other words, just enough. You know, it's really easy to become obsessive in this practice and think that I have to note everything, and I have to sort of tune into everything, and I have, and you become sort of like, gripping your chair and going, "Oh no, I didn't see that last thing. I didn't note it. Oh my God, what?" No, just to the extent necessary is all you really need, to the extent necessary, to can maintain continuous mindfulness. And how much is that? Good luck. I mean, everybody has to figure that out for themselves, and everybody finds their own equation for what's the extent necessary. And sometimes, in some situations, you're in this really quiet place, you're on a retreat, you've been practicing for a while, the extent necessary could be quite a bit less than if you're in some sort of chaotic, noisy place and you need to really focus and bear down. So once again, it's always about balance, and it's about experience, practicing and seeing what happens. The also thing about the extent necessary is the Buddha's teachings, people are always talking about the middle path. Not too much and not too little. Somewhere between being overly zealous and being laid back. Somewhere in the middle between those two is the extent necessary. That's by the middle path. We're always trying to find the optimum thing where if I go too far out, I'm expending so much energy that I'm wearing myself out, and I won't be able to continue practicing because I've literally burned out. But if I'm just being sort of laid back, no, whatever happens, that's okay. I don't even have to pay attention. I'm just here being this blissful body, experiencing the world. Well, this might be a little too little. Somewhere in the middle is what we're always trying to find. And that's the middle path. If part of what happens in this world of what I'm talking about is if we're not careful, we start judging our practice. Like, "Oh, I'm not serious enough. I'm not trying hard enough. There must be something wrong with me. What's wrong with me? Oh, I'm a bad meditator," blah, blah, blah. Guaranteed way to make yourself miserable. And it just gets in the way of practicing. Judgment is just another thing that arises like any other emotion. But we take it so seriously. We believe our self-judgments much too much. And I'm not saying you can't learn from, in a skillful way, "Oh, I have to put more energy into this right now," But to sit there and judge yourself for being bad or wrong or not a good meditator, none of that stuff is useful at all. It just gets in the way. And so that's another way of looking at the middle path. It's like I'm not judging, over judging, I'm not beating myself up, but at the same time, I'm making sure I'm putting in enough effort to the extent necessary. And it's an interesting place to balance. And then, of course, the Buddha says, the last line is, "And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world." This is Buddhist code for being enlightened. And what he's saying is, every one of these instructions, when you really tune into it and practice it diligently, can lead towards enlightenment. Stating it flat out. And this whole thing I've been talking about, this refrain gives us a way to sort of take a particular instruction, like just mindfulness of breath, and refine it to the place where, "And he abides independent, not clinging to anything." Clinging is another part of Buddhist code words. Clinging always means wanting something too much, holding on to something, or trying really hard to push something away, which we do. They're both to push something away. You first have to get a really good grip on it. You got to cling it before you can fling it, right? And so either way, we have to watch for that tendency, not clinging to anything in the world, is what the phrase is. So that's what I want you to sort of, I wanted to do this because I want you to be aware of the nuance, in the sense of the Buddhist teachings, when it comes to just paying attention to breath and body sensation, which is what we did for the first 2 weeks. And then let's just practice with these thoughts in mind, but don't become obsessed by them. Just, especially if you're sort of more of a beginner and you're just trying to figure things out, just, you know, as we have been doing the last 2 weeks, just pay attention to breath and note the ins and outs or the quality of the breath. Then if you open up wider into body sensation in the broadest sense, start noting, you know, which sense door has been activated, you know, whether it was, you know, hearing, seeing, smelling, touching, tasting, thinking. And then once again, starting to be a little more precise by using words that really simply describe the quality of that sensation. You know, it turning into body, physical body sensation, what it feels like sitting in that chair, it might be hard or soft or lumpy or, you know, uncomfortable or comfortable, whatever. We have words that describe sensation, and we all have our own vocabulary for how we describe sensation. So you find what works for you. So what I'd like to do now is just sit for half an hour. I have some more things to say about the sutta afterwards, but I want you to take these ideas I've been presenting and put them into practice and see what happens with them. So people listening to this recording will want to, at this point, once I finish talking, just turn off the recording, sit for as long as it feels comfortable, 30 minutes is what I'm suggesting. Then turn it back on and listen to the rest of what I have to say later. So let's start by finding that comfortable upright position where we feel solid, steady, grounded, awake, alert. And then just start tuning in and noting what's arising. Remember, we want to note every 3 or 4 seconds. So it might be you just hang in there with breathing for a while first, noting the in and the out of the breath. Then as you open wider, whatever catches your attention more than anything else, that's what you note. Then you stay with that sensation and sort of feel it more deeply, see it even in those 3 or 4 seconds, all the various bits of it and the fact that it's changing, perhaps. And then you note again whatever's now catching your attention, which might be the same thing, it might not, it's all okay. It doesn't have to be anything other than what it is. And if the mind does wander and start to get lost in who knows what stories, thinking, planning, wondering why you're here, who knows? And you notice that, then you just start again. You just say, okay, I'm going to start noting again. Say that silently to yourself. And then you just start again. And then your mind wanders eventually again, and then you just start again. That's all we can ever do, is just keep starting again. Nothing more than that. So, now I'm going to stop talking and just let us sit for 30 minutes. So what I've spoken about and taught up till now from the sutta is the most common forms of mindfulness of body instruction that are given. But there are three other sections of mindfulness of body in the sutta. And I wanted to just talk about them because they each have a certain emphasis. The first of these, is what's called a body scan. It's just the principal method that S.N. Goenka, one of the famous teachers of mindfulness, who a lot of the senior teachers in this lineage that I'm part of in the West studied with him at some point. And this was what he taught more than anything else. And the idea is that you actually go through the body, tuning into each particular part of it one at a time. And then you stay with that sensation in that part of the body, and then you move on to the next, and the next, and the next. And this is the actual instructions here that the Buddha gave. Again, monks, he reviews this body up from the soles of the feet and down from the top of the hair, enclosed by skin, as full of all kinds of impurities. Thus, in this body there is head hair, body hair, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, bowels, contents of the stomach, feces, bile, phlegm, pus, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. Just as though there were a bag which is open at both ends, full of many sorts of grains, such as hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millets, and wheat, white rice, a man with good eyes were to open it and review it thus. This is a hill of rice. This is red rice. So he views the body. So what he's pointing to here, and Goenka would actually have you focus more externally before some of the more internal things. But what was going on here is the Buddha was trying to make clear to his disciples that we often, if we're not careful, focus totally on the external elements of body, you know, skin and appearance and those sorts of things. And we don't see that inside, basically, it's full of things like, you know, fat and tears and grease and spittle and snot. You know, that it's, the body is actually underneath that beautiful surface, just pretty gross. And it makes the intent of this instruction was to make his students understand that the body is just like a sack of grain. It's no different. Things come go in one end and out the other, literally. And that it isn't all joy and beauty, that there's a lot of internal stuff there that is less than beautiful. So that's one of the sets of instructions. And I'm trying not to make it sound ooky, but it always seemed kind of ooky to me. And I tried practicing this a little bit, and it just never suited me. I know other people who swear by this form of the practice. This is the most important instruction the Buddha ever gave about mindfulness of body. And so everybody finds what works for them. And so I'm just being honest. This doesn't work for me. I know people who think this is just like absolutely the best way to practice. So if you want to experiment with something like this, feel free to do so. And then this is yet another way of thinking about the body. And again, monks, reviews this same body, however it is placed, however disposed, as consisting of the elements. Thus, in this body, there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. So this is classic physiology 2,600 years ago. But it's also the classic physiology used in Ayurveda teachings today. Ayurveda being an Indian form of medicine and medical diagnosis, and it looks at how everything in the body is really just some conglomeration of these four elements, and in all the various pieces of the body. So you know, the bones, if you were actually feeling your bones, that might be earth element. You know, you're feeling the you've got some saliva in your mouth, that might be water element. But it gets to be interesting because things like you feel your stomach digesting food, well, that's fire, because it's fire, it's the heat that makes food digest. So there's some ways of looking at this that are distinctly based on Ayurvedic teachings. But in the Buddhist day, everybody didn't think of that. It was just like, well, what? Everybody knows this. This is like the normal way of thinking about things. And what he's trying to do here is make people see that really, you know, this, we think of this as some solid thing, but really it's just a mixture of all these elements, and in various places, one particular set of that mixture predominates. Bones are earth. You know, saliva is water, etc. But it's not that simple, and it's a way to look at the body from a totally different point of view. I mean, we never, in our Western world, would never think of looking at the body this way. But to the students the Buddha had 2,600 years ago, this was how everybody thought about the body, that it had these four elements made up everything. And it made us also see that really that's all the body is. It's just a conglomeration of these elements interacting with each other. There's no solidity, there's no permanence, there's nothing other than these four elements interacting, constantly interacting in the interplay of these elements. I mean, once again, I know people who have studied this who swear by this particular method of practice. Like, they actually, a lot of their time is just they're noting which element of these four elements is predominant at any one moment in their experience. Another valid way to practice, right? And then we have this final one. This is, I'll read this. Again, monks, as though he were to see a corpse thrown aside in a charnel ground, 1, 2, or 3 days dead, bloated, livid, and oozing matter, being devoured by crows, hawks, vultures, dogs, jackals, or various kinds of worms. Or a skeleton with flesh and blood held together with sinews. Or a skeleton smeared with blood held together with sinews. A skeleton without flesh and blood, disconnected bones scattered in all directions, bones bleached white the color of shells, bones heaped up more than a year old, bones rotten and crumbling to dust. He compares this same body with it thus. This body too is of the same nature. It will be like that. It is not exempt from that fate. So now this teaching was all about making people tune into the impermanence of their own body by seeing another body that used to be, someone thought was permanent, and then it's gone. It's gone. There's a reference here to the charnel grounds. Traditionally, in the villages all over India, the really rich people got to be cremated. Everybody else, they just took the bodies outside the edge of the village someplace where there's what was literally a charnel ground, and they just leave the body there. And it would slowly decay, just as he's describing, step by step by step by step. And the Buddha would encourage his monks to go sit in these charnel grounds, to actually tune into what's actually happening as a body disappears. This body we thought was permanent and solid, literally, after years, just a heap of dust and a few bones that maybe haven't rotted completely. And this is a process that everybody goes through. I'm not recommending you go sit in the charnel ground. I don't know if there's probably in India, there's probably no charnel grounds anymore. This is like, there might be in some remoter parts of India. But if you're interested in looking at bodies in a different way, and I've done this several times, I've taken some anatomy courses where we actually look at and dissect bodies. We can actually go in and actually, with instruction, I would never do any of the dissection, but it's a standard medical thing. But it also, I used to teach a lot of yoga, and people wanted to understand how bodies work, so it would go to these anatomy labs. And you see a body lying on the table, and the anatomist will like put a slice off something and peel back the skin, and there's like flesh. Looks like if you chopped it up and wrapped it in cellophane, it would be meat on at the meat counter. That's what it looks like. It's no different than that. And it was like, oh. And then he would start taking things apart and looking at bones and how joints work and all that sort of stuff. But it's a way to sort of see that this turns into that without exception. And it's like, so this is a way to practice where you're focusing on impermanence, on the fact that things are always going to change and always go in that direction, sooner or later. Different ways to practice, different ways to teach, different ways to look at things. And I wanted to mention those just sort of to be complete in a sense. Those are the six different sets of instructions that the Buddha gave on mindfulness of body. So we had breath, we had what are called body positions, walking, standing, seated, lying down. And then there's like just tuning into all the various external things that the body can do. It extends and it stretches and bends forward. It consumes food, it digests food, etc. And then these three, which are less commonly taught and less commonly practiced, to my knowledge, but they're all very valid ways of practicing, depending on your inclination and your curiosity and whatever else, however else you want to look at it. So that's the end of what I want to say about mindfulness of body. And so next week, we're going to start looking at mental formations, and actually the rest of this 9-week course is more about the mind. The Buddha was a great psychologist long before people would use that term, and he really looked at the mind very carefully and understood it, and then taught how the mind works, so that once we see how it works, then we can start working with it skillfully and instead of letting the mind sort of just run wild. And that's what the rest of the 6 weeks are going to be, progressively looking at various things the Buddha said about how the mind works. and how to use that understanding in practice. But before we do that, I wanted to sort of, at this point, open the floor, as I always do at this point. And if anybody has anything they want to say or share, that's fine. And if not, that's fine too. Don't feel obliged to entertain me. Deborah, go ahead.
I find the body scan often useful at the beginning of a meditation as a way of settling. So the way to combine practice, but just to get in my body and get here.
Yeah, whatever works. Yeah. And I've heard other people say exactly the same thing, by the way, that they do body scan, two or three passes of body scan, and then sort of open up into sort of more just, well, what's happening now, as opposed to directing your attention so much. So just another way to concentrate, I think, as you, what you just described. Yeah.
Barry, I have two questions. Is mindfulness of the body practice used to help understand non-self?
Well, certainly, you know, the mindfulness of body in the sense of seeing things that, you know, like it said in the refrain, where we start to see things are arising and things are passing. When you start to really notice that being the predominant thing you notice, you go, well, wait, where's the self in all that arising and passing?
Okay.
So we start to see things more distinctly. There are, as we go on, some work on the level of mental formations that are much more precise in terms of working with those ideas as well. So as we go deeper into the mindfulness practice and understanding how our mind works, we start to see how we create a sense of separate self by how we think.
Okay.
And we start to see how that is just what we think. It has no reality in the absolute sense at all. And that's where we're headed. So we'll get to more of that as time goes along. But even mindfulness of body in and of itself, you know, we start to see how impermanent, I mean, you know, this, the thing about the, watching the corpse decay is like, yeah, just like, you know, and you can do that to a small extent. I mean, maybe you have a garden and you watch, right now the flowers are coming up, you know, and our tulips have come up and we watched them and they were beautiful. Now the tulips are disappearing already, some of them. Maybe some dwarf tulips that in a couple of days will be just back flat stuff on the dirt. So
are the tulips up in the Boulder area?
Oh yeah, already our tulips are up. And our daffodils and all kinds of stuff.
Okay.
Grape hyacinths. But they'll all be gone in a couple of weeks. Just like that. They rose out of the ground, out of nowhere. They're there for a while, then they're gone. So you have not to look at a physical body. If you're talking about noticing things externally instead of internally, if you really look at what's growing in your garden, for instance, exactly what's happening. They arise, they're there for a while, then they're gone. And we start to see everything is like that. So it's a way to focus on that idea in a quite external day-to-day sense of, you know, even if you don't garden, you know, you watch right now all the trees are budding and leafing out and starting, all the leaves are beautiful. You know, come November in Boulder, all those trees are bare. What happened to all those leaves? They came, they arose, they're there for a while, and then they're gone. except the ones I have to rake, but even they're gone. I mean, you know. So it's like we're looking at these, start to see these cycles internally and externally.
And the other question I had, is there a reason for mindfulness of the body to meditate on some of those ideas that you gave us, like the four elements or something, to help with any of the hindrances?
Not particular. They're just different forms of practice, and some
Okay.
people are attracted more to one than to another.
It doesn't have anything to do with the hindrances.
No, I'll talk about the hindrances in a couple of weeks,
Okay.
3 weeks, and talk about eventually about how what the antidotes to the hindrances are and how to work with them skillfully. That's all coming soon to a Dhamma talk near you.
Well, you know, it gets all kind of, so I wanted to try to clarify my mind here.
Well, it's like what I'm trying to do is be very progressive and actually work through the teachings exactly as the Buddha worked through them. So don't worry, we're getting there.
Yeah, and it doesn't hurt to hear it over and over and over.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Any other thoughts, comments, questions?
It's interesting that I tend to think of this body is mine, you know. You know, this arm is Carl's arm, you know, and also, without even thinking about it, that I exist in my head somewhere, you know, and behind my eyes, you know. Carl is in there somewhere.
And that's part of what the Buddha's teachings is about when you get into the nitty-gritty details, is breaking down those concepts to start to see that those are just ideas. You know, for instance, the idea of hand, okay? This is hand. Hand is just the concept. Really, all that's there is sensation that we, when we put all those sensations together and we repeat that process over and over and over again, over time we learn to call that mass of sensation hand. But it's just sensation. You know, baby, if my little babies are doing this, so I go, what's this thing up here? You know, they don't know what it is. They don't have a name for it. They're sort of learning to tune into those sensations, and eventually someone tells them when they're two, that's all, oh, that's your hands, son. But until then, it was just a massive sensation. That's all it was. And that's the same with all those physical things we think are solid. They're just, and then you look at this hand and you go, is this hand, this is a totally different hand than 7 years ago. Almost every cell in your body gets replaced every 7 years, except a few, some brain things and things like that. So is this the same hand I had 7 years ago? No. Looks sort of the same, a little more lined and beaten up, and a few more nicks and scars from doing carpentry, but same old, it's not, same old sensations. Other comments, thoughts?